Please be seated.
A document has made its way over your desk, and I wonder...
Is it still on my desk?
Oh, sorry, it's your name. It's the name. It's okay. It'll get put back up in due course.
Okay.
Right.
I know who I am.
Sorry, I just have to answer the question
for Commissioner Bunter
before the break.
Which was?
Are all of the Manuhinakea consents in?
Yeah.
I'm advised that there are two missing. There are two Land Pro clients and they are going to be filed shortly.
Mm-hmm.
But out of all of them in the Manu, there's two missing.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, Mr. Moore.
Yes, thank you, Your Honour. I now call Dr. Allibone, who's made his way to his seat. Confirm that your full name is Richard Mark Allibone?
Yes.
And you are a Director and Principal Ecologist of Waterways Consulting Limited?
Yes.
You have prepared a Statement of Evidence in Chief dated 7 December 2020?
Yes.
And a Statement of Evidence in Reply dated 19 February 2021?
Yes.
And you have set out your qualifications and experiences in paragraphs 3 to 14 of your Evidence in Chief?
Yes.
Are there any corrections that you would like to make to your evidence in chief or your evidence in reply?
I have two small typos I'd just like to fix. On page 11 of the evidence in chief, paragraph 40, on the second last line it reads, and seven of the Otago fish taxa have either. Can we replace either with the? So it reads, have the CD qualifier.
Thank you.
And the second correction is in paragraph 42 on page 12. At the end of the third sentence, it reads ranking. It should read ranked, just ED, not ING. Thank you.
Sorry, which line was that?
Section 42, line 3.
Ranked, not ranking.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. And subject to those corrections, do you confirm that your statements of evidence are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I do.
Now, I understand you've prepared a summary of the key points covered in your evidence and your evidence in chief.
I have.
If you could please state that for the court and then remain for any questions from the court or from my friends.
Okay. Your Honour, I'll start from paragraph 4 on the summary.
Paragraph 4, not 21. Okay.
The summary from which the witness is reading from hasn't been provided to the court. It's a summary he's prepared.
Sorry.
Okay. Less than helpful. Firstly, it shouldn't be an opportunity to address new evidence or to provide new evidence, and of course that's the problem that the parties in the court are going to have.
It is a summary from his evidence and his evidence in reply, but capturing the salient points. And we do have written copies available if that would assist.
Yep. Who wants a copy? Everybody? Everybody wants a copy. You got that? Have you got copies so you can distribute those, please? Thank
yes.
Will be a fast
10 minutes,
3 minutes a page.
Yes, this is by far the longest of the summaries that will follow from the balance of the witnesses.
Alrighty. Okay. Well, we're in Dr. Alaban's hands. Yeah. If you could start reading from the summary.
Sorry. Native freshwater fish fauna of Otago. The number of recognised native freshwater fish species and indeterminate taxa in Otago is 31 taxa. The present day taxa can be split into 15 diadema species that migrate to and from the sea and 16 taxa that complete their full life history in freshwater. 15 of the taxa are also classified as threatened, and this includes 13 non-migratory galaxids and one closely related mudfish. The fish distribution maps in my evidence in chief have been provided to provide geographic context in terms of the distributions of threatened fish. The maps do not indicate any priority for management. In addition, I did not note in my evidence in chief the data quality issues that are present with the fish survey records, in particular, the difficulty with determining historic data from current data and the accuracy of the data at the fine scale of stream reaches. The key threat to non-migratory galaxids is predation and competition by or with introduced salmonids. Habitat loss via habitat alteration and or water abstraction has local effects and is a serious threat to mudfish. Water quality is a limited issue aside from areas where low flows or intensive agriculture may create detrimental conditions. For migratory species, loss of fish passage is a significant issue causing range contraction. For 13 threatened non-migratory galaxids, 4 occur in the periphery of Otago with their main population centres outside Otago. Of the 9 Otago taxa, 2 occur in areas of high levels of water abstraction and irrigation and significant interactions occur. For other taxa, water abstraction occurs within their geographic range, but interactions are more limited. The evidence of other experts have provided indicates varying degrees of support for my listing and prioritisation of threats to the non-migratory galaxid species. Dr. Olson agrees with the list, and Dr. Dunn agrees in part, but considers hydrological alteration by human activities to be the greatest threat to non-migratory galaxids. I agree with Mr. Dunn that extreme hydrological alterations are a concern and can lead to extirpation of non-migratory galaxid populations. Dry stream reaches or stream reaches flooded by reservoirs will not support non-migratory galaxid populations. However, the effects of less extreme hydrological alteration on non-migratory galaxids are complex, and some flow alterations are used to protect non-migratory galaxids. While Plan Change 7 will not establish residual flows and remove drying reaches, these drying reaches are often important features that protect galaxid populations, and these flow alterations should be addressed individually. There are 2 factors I would reiterate with respect to the assessment of threats presented by water abstraction versus salmonids or introduced predatory fish on non-migratory galaxids. A, the first is the reversibility of the 2 threats. The effect of water abstraction can be reversed by removing the abstraction structures and halting the abstraction, whereas salmonid removal is significantly more challenging. The second reason I consider salmonids are a greater threat to the non-migratory galaxids in Otago is that salmonids are present over a much greater area of Otago, and this greater geographic range increases their potential to impact on non-migratory galaxids. Galaxid taxonomic issues are still to be resolved, and we have limited knowledge of the general ecology of approximately half the taxa. Where are we now? Knowledge limitations are more significant when assessing environmental tolerances and the effects of water abstraction. I have undertaken work for the Otago Regional Council since 2018, and as part of this work I have reviewed the state of ecological data available for ORC for the planning purposes. Included in this review process has been the habitat models for the Arrow, Cadrona and Manaherikia catchments that found the Manaherikia Galloway and Cadrona habitat models would both benefit from being updated, and for the Manaherikia an additional model would be appropriate for the Ofa-Omakau reach of the Manaherikia River. Habitat preference curves for various species, e.g. trout, also required updating, and habitat for invertebrates and algal species needed to be modelled. The state of ecological data is also varied. Some key areas have limited current data. For example, the Lower Cadrona River has little recent sampling. Recent work I've undertaken at the Cadrona River found previously unreported common bully and also located longfin eels that have not been recorded in the Cadrona River in the New Zealand Freshwater Fish Database records since 1992. This does demonstrate the NZFFD doesn't always provide sufficient or up-to-date fisheries data. I did not list caveats about the NZFFD data in which evidence in chief. In my opinion, general distributions of most non-migratory galaxies are reasonably well known. However, there remain taxonomic issues to address, and at the scale of individual streams, the fisheries data is variable in quality. In addition, some of the NZFFD records should be regarded as historic rather than representing up-to-date presence, absence and abundance of data for fish in a water body. With respect to the habitat modelling as presented in 2018, I would consider this an overly optimistic assessment of the state of knowledge in the MAC catchments. With respect to habitat modelling, I agree with Dr. John Hayes' evidence outlining recommended habitat modelling methods and that the existing habitat models need to be reviewed and updated to account for the age of the models, whether they follow best practice and use up-to-date habitat preferences for a range of aquatic taxa, not just fish. I expect there will be significant requirement for updating, replacing and adding to the habitat model resources available to ORC. This leads me to support Mr. De Plessmaker's opinion that we are lacking information. The existing data is patchy and at times relies on historic fisheries data. While the ORC has previously commissioned habitat models, these will need updating and I expect additional models will be required for establishing the water management regime and the land and water regional plan. With respect to fish screens, I maintain the importance of screens is less for non-migratory galaxies than for migratory or diadema species. This is because only a portion of a non-migratory fish population will be exposed to the entrainment risk at a water take, whereas the majority or all of the individuals of migratory species are exposed to entrainment into water races. I note that recent research has provided important information on the movement of larval non-migratory galaxids and provides important information for any screen requirement assessment. The PC7 process does allow time for fish screen requirements for non-migratory galaxids to be better understood before setting consent conditions for water takes. Flushing flows. I agree with Mr. Cole that flushing flows are desirable and have ecological benefits. However, flushing flows can only be provided by rainfall events, and in Central Otago, rainfall events are often unpredictable in their occurrence. Minimum flows and allocation limits should be used together to protect ecological values, and the two have different roles. The minimum flows are set to prevent unacceptable ecological impacts due to the abstraction-induced low flow. Water allocation has a role in preventing flatlining of river flows and providing for flow variation that can improve habitat conditions and refresh a stream during summer low flow periods. Water allocation at annual, monthly or other durations can be used to adjust flows and account for variation in fresh events desired.
When I read your evidence and I understand your evidence, but when I first read the evidence in chief, I had wondered what issues in the plan change, as understood by the regional council or as brought to light by submitters, what issues was your brief actually addressing? So it's telling me a lot about galaxids.
There was some, particularly one statement in Professor Skelton's evidence saying, or his report, sorry, not evidence, but said the plan as it currently is being used represents a threat to non-migratory galaxids in Otago. So part of it was to inform the court that as a suite, the non-migratory galaxids, it concerns two species, not all of the species. So the distributional info overlaid with the water abstraction info, where the sites are, was there to demonstrate that while there is an issue, it centres around Central Otago Roundhead and Clutha Flatheads. The other 9 or 10 species, however many you sort of designate, because we haven't got the taxonomy 100%, are less exposed to water abstraction issues. So Plan Change 7 and the water plan process goes with it. If you're worried about threatened non-migratory galaxids, it's not all of them. And the use of the lumping them all together as they're all at threat is incorrect, in my opinion. It's two species that are exposed to a lot of water abstraction impacts, effects, not the whole suite. So it's, again, it's just trying to clarify where the issue lies, both geographically and in terms of which species are most vulnerable.
And you mentioned flatheads, and what was the other one?
Central Otago Roundhead is the most threatened, or it occurs, all of its populations essentially occur within the footprint of irrigation areas or abstraction areas, and then Clutha Flathead is the other one. And the rest, much lesser degree of interaction with water abstraction.
So this brief was responding to something that Professor Skelton had said and just providing more detail around the statement that he had made.
In part, yes. And I did notice in one point in the ORC's description, it also mentions, sort of reiterated Prof Skelton's comment about threats to non-migratory galaxids. And just, yeah, it's clarification that it's not all the threatened non-migratory galaxids that are subject to significant interaction with water abstraction. And I guess the other reason for talking about salmon is, again, to, while this has been put up as one of the issues for Plan Change 7, either for or against, is that, to my opinion, it's the salmonids that are a bigger threat. The water abstraction is an issue, but there are other issues that we could address and make substantial gains in terms of reducing the threat.
Okay, and so with that clarification in mind, how does this plan change respond to that, or does it in fact not respond to that because it doesn't need to respond to any particular issue to dealing with non-migratory galaxids?
Okay. I think there actually we're grappling with two issues. Mm-hmm. One is how you manage the non-migratory galaxids, and for some parts of Otago that has a really strong relationship with water abstraction management because mm-hmm. they're in the same spots. Other parts of the non-migratory galaxy management are outside the water abstraction areas, and it's simply a fisheries management issue. So that's one bit. The other part of Plan Change 7 is partly what I've addressed with the comments on the habitat modelling, is how we understand the catchments in ecological terms for trout, invertebrates, native fish, algal species, and the habitat modelling in the ecological flow development is what Plan Change 7 will allow us to improve. At the moment, we've got to the stage with the Manahara Care where we have habitat models linked to Goldsim and a lot of information now on how habitat will change with flow. But for catchments like the Tairi, we have one habitat model that was built in probably 1999 around the Middlemarch area, and the rest of the catchment has no habitat modelling or information that we can relate flow changes to changes in habitat. So for instance, that catchment, we need to do a fair bit more. Same with the Cadrona, where we've been trying to replace, again, a 1999 habitat model with a more up-to-date one that we understand, so that when it comes to a hearing process, we can explain that model to the commissioners and we can present it to stakeholders. This is what's actually going on. So that's the other part of where I'm coming to Plan Change 7. It gives the time to develop these models rather than doing consents when we don't understand the catchments and granting consents on what we hope is okay with not a lot of understanding of ecological change with flow change.
And so moving on into the future, is it your understanding that under the land and water plan, which now will be an integrated whole of catchment, Malcolm to the sea, Kūtaki Tai, which isn't necessarily a lineal concept as I understand it, approach, that when linking to a minimum flow, the habitat modelling itself links to a model of the hydrological conditions within a catchment, correct?
You can do. We've done in the Manuhiri Care is a first off, as far as Mr. Lloyd and I are aware, where we've managed to link quite a complex hydrological water allocation model, Goldsim, and it predicts flows, and now we can... The habitat models provide an output of, at this flow you get X amount of habitat for this species at this point in the river. We can link that to the Goldsim outputs and generate real-time series, because Goldsim works for 47 years of flow data. For each day on that 47 years, we can generate now the habitat available to a suite of species at about 70% of the river length. And we can sum that up and see how changes occur through time. Now, we've never done that before. Normally, you would just take the habitat model and say at 1 cumic, we're starting to lose habitat quite rapidly for this particular species, and that's the one we value. We don't want to go below that point. And then you would look at a duration curve in the river and say, oh, yeah, we only get to 1 cumic, say, 4 or 5 days a year, or we would get naturally to 1 cumic at 40 or 50 days a year in summer, and you'd weigh up the... And decide where you put the minimum flow, balancing that natural flow regime that the hydrologists give you and the habitat you want to keep for the particular species of value. That makes sense?
Yep.
So
when you say natural flow, you mean naturalised flow, so that's a calculation of the volume of water.
Gets back to what Mr. Henderson was discussing earlier today. If it's a river with... in its natural state, it would just be the flow as it is. Mm. If it's been modified, yes, you go to a naturalised, or ideally you go to a naturalised flow if you can. And the Manuhiri Care is an example where we're struggling to get the flow naturalised, so you might not link it back to a natural flow. You would simply say at these particular flows, we're meeting a habitat target for a particular species that we desire.
So that kind of sounds like business as usual, but quite sophisticated. We're looking at minimum flows, we're looking at, you know, habitat output, you know, as it correlates with those minimum flows. What's that got to do with Mana Rotowai and putting the health of the water first? The water, not as a resource or a commodity, but water first.
I think if you put aside the heavily abstracted catchments, now you looked at the ones that are basically unmodified or lightly modified, you were looking at it and saying, well, this is the river in its natural state and it provides this type of stuff. If we alter it by this much in terms of the flow regime, we're doing a small amount of alteration in the habitat available for the species. Remember, the models are habitat models. They're not models of abundance of the species. So we're telling you how much habitat they have. They may or may not fill that habitat. But anyway, then you look at it as for Te Mana Owai and say, okay, well, we haven't diverged far from the natural, so we're probably still supporting that, you know, life-supporting capacity and general values. The tricky bit is it's not a cut-off at a certain point where you don't meet it. It's going to be a gradual sort of... At the end point of no water, you're definitely not meeting it. Natural flow, you definitely are. Somewhere in the middle of those come together, you decide, no, sort of not meeting it, to yes, we are. And it struck me when looking at these sort of things, it's very easy to write the rule of, you know, life-supporting capacity and so on. You have to get a river very dry before it's not meeting any life-supporting capacity. And the Te Mana Rotowai sort of, it's a concept, but how we fit that into a gradual sort of change in how the river supports life is a difficult call. And then when you move to the heavily abstracted catchments where you've got a lot of existing use, you can point to this flow looks good for meeting the Mana Rotowai requirements, but that is an abstraction that's, say, 50% of the existing use. And then you have a problem about how you manage, you know, we've got too much water being taken from the river potentially to meet that objective.
Mm. Yeah, so And with that in mind, what involvement have you had with the Regional Council in conceptualising in a policy way what does Tamana Rotumai means, if that's your starting point, possibly your ending point as well?
I've had none.
None. Who in the Regional Council has been having those discussions? That you are aware?
You'd have to have a check with Mr. De Placemaker.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you haven't been approaching catchment models, and you've given the example of Marahere Care, with an outcome with the fundamental concept of Te Mana Rotuai in mind. That hasn't then reset what you are doing or thinking around.
No, what we've been trying to do with the Manahera Care is just develop a model that works, that we're happy with. That
a model of what, though? A model is just a mathematical representation of the environment, which depends on it, which is making a prediction, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
A prediction in this case about naturalised flows.
The Goldson model makes a whole suite of predictions, not just natural. It doesn't actually go to naturalised flow. It deals with the water runoff you get from rainfall and then the amount of water you need to irrigate the existing irrigation allocation blocks, and it has a storage module in there for how much water you've got stored that you can feed into irrigation or to the minimum flow. And then it provides at node points in the river the flow at that node, say a confluence of tributaries, both the inflowing tributary and the upstream main stem, so that you've got flows at points on the river that we can then link to the habitat model. And because tributaries are at distinct points and so are the takes, you can say from this take to this tributary, the flow is X. So in that 3 kilometres of river, we've got, say, a cumec, and we know from the habitat model how much habitat it predicts is present at a cumec. So we can sum that along the river. But what we've got is it's basically trying to build a model that all of the tag agree represents the river as best we can, and then when the Manahere Care reference group says this is what we want the river to provide in terms of habitat or particular values, we say, well, if you want to have an excellent trout fishery, for instance, in this reach, you'll need about this much water. Or if you go above this flow, in fact, you don't get any more habitat because some of the habitats at a certain flow will plateau. So you add more water, you don't get more habitat. And we can say, well, here's the maximum you get. So you can, once you get the values from the community, whether it's in like the MRG or a FMU process with community objectives, then you go to the model and say, you're looking for these things, here's where you get them, at these flows. So what we have is the model to inform the community then, or the end users, this is how you get what you want to get to, or this is the trade-off. So if you have this, because it's linked to allocation, the Goldson one in particular, if you want a really high residual or minimum flow, that means less water available for out-of-stream use. So there's you've got X amount of restriction on your irrigation. So you can weigh up the options. So the whole Goldson model is a scenario tester. Of if we do this, what do we get in terms of habitat? Or if we do this, what do we get in terms of irrigation reliability? And how do we balance them? Where's the sweet spot? Is there one that meets both the ecological objectives and the out-of-stream ones? And the reason we've spent a lot of time on it is because it's obviously a crucial decision process for Central Otago water users and environmental interests, that we get this right. So we've built probably the best model we've ever done to address that. But that's taken a couple of years.
And remind me again, because I'm not sure to what extent this is well covered or well described in the evidence, but undoubtedly are known to some people in this room. What does this modelling is a representation of the naturalised flow or something else?
The Goldson, what it has is it runs a whole suite of different flow scenarios. Mm. Now, we have one flow scenario which is called Falls Dam Full.
Called what, sorry?
Falls Dam is full.
Falls Dam.
So,
right,
yeah, so basically, as water flows in, it has to flow out. It's got no storage. Mm. And then we have no irrigation. So that's our baseline, that basically we're taking no water out, we're not storing any water. Mm. And then we can run a status quo scenario, which is basically the river as it is today. with the voluntary.
You say as today, and again, yep. Forgive me, but as today, complete with the existing land uses, surrounding
yes.
land uses.
Yep.
And so your model. Your model is making predictions about the flow in the river, which is, you know, an element of hydrology that, you know, I'm not quite sure whether it's talking to substrate, you know, or the bed of the river or whatever. But anyway, flows in the river, you're making a prediction as in the surrounding land use.
And, well, what it does is it tells you it's got about 7 or 8 blocks of irrigation allocation.
Yeah.
So for this patch like Chatto Creek or Thompson's Creek, it will tell you this is how much water is available for use in here under this scenario, and it will link to the we have the irrigation area in that catchment plotted, modelled from ground truth real irrigation information, so we know how much water it needs. So if we're only getting, say, 40% of it, it will tell you the reliability of supply, and it will tell you what's left in the river. Now, the model we've run at the moment for about 8 different scenarios prioritises the minimum flow. So it's got a range of minimum flows at campground and it has to meet. And then everything else has to be adjusted as the model runs. The irrigation use, for instance, is reduced as the flow drops so that you maintain the minimum flow. At the moment, the model was there, it's developed, we're all pretty happy with it. Now we just need to answer the questions the community wants in terms of what scenarios do they want to see. Running it.
Is that model a complete answer to the NPS? Because it's been, I think you're articulating it as if it is. And I put to you again, if it's all about minimum flows and ecology, then why would we need an NPS?
Oh, no, it doesn't answer at all. And one of the, and it depends really, again, how complex you make that scenario as well and what objectives you're looking for. And how well we can relate an objective, you know, a community objective, to the models we can do. And there are some gaps in terms of, one of the things we see in the model was, for instance, is trout habitat basically doesn't increase at campground where the flow recorder is. When you get above 2 cumics, it seems to flatten out. And you can add more and more water and you don't get any more trout habitat. But invertebrate habitat increases through the whole flow range. So essentially it says the bigger the flow, the more food you've got. You don't get more fish. So if the community objective is just sort of a bit of trout habitat, you can get it at 2 cumics. If they want big trophy fish, then you would actually go to a much higher flow because they get more food. And that's reflecting also the health of the river. The more invertebrate and, you know, life you've got in it, you would say the more it meets that Manitowai. But again, it becomes a very... it's conceptual or judgment call on where you say enough meets it, or you've taken it too far below a line to say it doesn't meet that because there's no set range for it to be in.
So if you if the community view was that you wanted to take, I don't know, nitrates from a level of toxicity grade D, whatever that's equivalent to, and bring it up to grade A under the NPS, that you were going to allow 30 years for that to happen, but in the meantime you had to move from D to C, and that had to happen within the next 10 years, how would that then impact on the flow regime? How would your model respond to that?
It wouldn't. It's not a water quality model.
Because it's not a water quality,
yeah.
And it's everything to do with the surrounding land use. So,
yeah.
So then, that's what I'm getting at. The model isn't the complete answer to everything in this NPS, is it?
No, it's not.
No, because the NPS makes it clear that you're interested in land and water integration.
Yeah.
Okay. So the model is the answer to what question?
It's based around habitat, you know, how much habitat is available to organisms, and about water allocation for out-of-stream use. It can show you the balance between those two factors as you change the scenarios.
Right. But it doesn't actually then factor in the impact of land use, land activities on, say, water quality.
No, it won't do that.
That which must impact on habitat or... maybe not so much habitat, but species abundance and all the rest of the stuff.
Again, that depends very much on the on-land management.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking you.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, if you wanted to adjust some of that, it might be riparian fencing, or it depends very much where your nutrient issues are coming from. Mm. If it's direct stock access to a stream, then you respond by fencing. If it's nitrates percolating through groundwater, then it's an irrigation application issue, which you would have to adjust. If it's phosphorus coming from overland flow, it's border dike and flood irrigation is probably a moving to spray irrigation, not just for efficiency, but for reducing phosphorus runoff might be the thing. So, it becomes a difficult thing to address depending on just where your nutrient or your water quality issues are arising.
Well, the proposition I'm putting to you is it's not that those land use issues are not the issues which are addressed under the model that you're talking about, the mud and head of care.
And it's never been intended to.
But there are wider questions under the NPS. And those questions would go to water quality and land use, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Yep, okay. That's that's helpful. Thank you. Oh, that is helpful.
Just coming back to the plan change we've got here, plan change 7.
Yes.
You've produced evidence, and at the end of your response, reply evidence, you talk about significant requirement for update and replacing, adding to the habitat model and so on. Is that for the more to do with the land plan, the water plan that's coming up, or how do you distinguish between what's required for this plan change?
Plan change, given we're running with basically just rolling things over for 6 years, what I mean is during that six-year period, it gives us time to develop the models we need for the final, the land and water plan. That under the using the current models is not particularly valid, or they just don't have them. So the six-year period gives you a grace period to develop new models, update the existing or check that the existing ones are still valid, and then when you do after the six-year period, when you're granting new consents, you have a much better basis, better plan, better informed by appropriate modelling that can then do a much better process.
So that's the focus of your evidence.
Yep.
Just looking at the current drafting of the Plan Change 7, have you looked at that to see whether your evidence has any significance in terms of, say, the matters of control?
So you're meaning Plan Change 7?
Yes,
not the. No, my evidence is aimed at part of the rationale behind Plan Change 7 is to give us time to develop the tools to do the land and water plan. It's not about the decision or how you assess consent under Plan Change 7, a lot of it. It's more about giving us the time to get it right.
Well, that was my interpretation, so thank you for confirming that. Thank you, Your Honour.
All right, are there other questions? Who are we with? Mr. Winchester.
I'll just briefly address the court. I had
intended... Oh, no, you've already foregone.
Well, I had intended to withdraw my my cross-examination of Dr. Allerbone, but I was listening to his views on Te Mana o Te Wai, and certainly I accept that they are at the invitation of the court. I didn't detect from his written evidence that that would be a matter he might opine upon. I just really want it noted for the record that I will not cross-examine Dr. Allerbone on the basis that he said he had not been asked to give a view on Te Mana o Te Wai for the purposes of the Regional Council's planning.
Would that be correct, Dr. Allerbone?
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
So he explicitly said that.
Yep.
And he has also explicitly, and I think correctly, and I'll make submissions on it, said that what is important is not just an ecological assessment, but one which is overlain with values, and that was the interchange he had with Your Honour. So I'll just leave it at that, but I wanted to have that on the record with your leave.
Yeah, no, absolutely, because I think these issues are important,
Indeed.
Te Mana o Te Wai being foundational to the NPS is important also because it from memory, although I have looked at the MPS, I haven't looked at it last week, I haven't looked at it with this in mind, but now the foundational element is tracking or should be tracking through all plan provisions, would that be right? Pretty much as we said in Southland. It suffuses everything that we are doing here to the extent that it's actually intended to. Yeah.
Indeed, both procedurally and substantively.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Ms. Baker Galloway. Oh, no, Ms. Williams.
I'm just going to come back here on the justice of the conscience that there's a microphone. That may make matters slightly easier than if I too say and speak from where I'm sitting. So. Dr. Allibone, thank you for explaining, I guess, the purpose of your evidence as being about the rationale for the plan change rather than perhaps addressed to the plan change. And I do appreciate that in relation to your really scene setting in terms of the freshwater fisheries and species that are in the Otago region, and providing some background to the court in terms of the fact that we do have in Otago this suite of, I'm going to call them non-diadromous, because that's the term that's adopted by Dr. Dunn, but non-diadromous galaxid species, which some people call non-migratory galaxid species, and they're probably reasonably interchangeable as terms, but just clarifying that up front. So, looking at your evidence, whilst you haven't prepared it perhaps to support Plan Change 7, there are two aspects of the plan change which are certainly relevant to the court's consideration and which I would like to discuss with you. And the first of those is the application of the minimum flows in Schedule 2A, where those flows are in the current schedule but are not yet, I'll put it this way, operative, because there was a requirement that either there be agreement of all current consent holders that the minimum flows could apply to them, or it was awaiting for the expiry of deemed permits in October this year. So, considering that those minimum flow figures are currently in the plan, those are not picked up by Plan Change 7 and would not be continued through. Can you tell me what your view is on that?
Well, that's kind of difficult to give an answer to. One of the issues that comes to mind straight away is that it depends, because there are minimum flows set on a number of rivers, and some of those have been set relatively recently, probably following some reasonable guidance, and they're also in areas where deemed permits in particular are uncommon if you went to South Otago, so it's really going to be little change.
So those ones I understand would continue. Mm. What I'm thinking of, I think it's particularly in the Tairi and the Manuhirikia, where there are existing minimum flows in the plan, but they are not applicable currently.
Yeah. Okay, well, the Manuhirikia can give you an answer, that simply the minimum flow is relevant for almost all of the year, if ever relevant, because it's set at OFA. Because it's set at OFA, but the minimum flow site is 820 litres at OFA, partway down the Manuhirikia. Now, when we're discharging water from Falls Dam to feed the four main irrigation takes, that's Blackstone and Omakau, which are upstream of OFA, then there are two downstream, the Manuhirikia take and the Galloway take. Now, as long as Galloway and Manuhirikia are being supplied with more than 820 litres a second, then you're always going to get 820 litres flowing past the minimum flow site. So if, say, Manuhirikia is taking a QMEC and Galloway 1400, well, that's got to be at least 400 at Galloway, 1400 passing OFA. Now, at the moment, the Manuhirikia users maintain a 900 litre a second minimum flow voluntary at Galloway as well, which exceeds the minimum flow. So if we carry on with the status quo and the voluntary minimum flow, the status quo will continue. The minimum flow is irrelevant for the Manuhirikia. For the Tyree, I'll take on board what Mr. Page was asking before about the control of the Manawatu Irrigation Company and how they, it would come down to how they supply water possibly, and I really would have to sit down and have a real careful think through any further on your question.
Do you accept that, given that these are flows which are in the plan now and which any current consent holder should have been anticipating would be applied, and indeed what you're telling me, some of them have voluntarily been applying them and a little bit more, do you accept that it is appropriate that that be something which carries on through for a controlled activity under Plan Change 7?
Not sure that's my place to say yes or no to, honestly.
All right, if you don't want to answer, that's fine.
Just not sure it's quite how
well,
I would answer that one.
Frame it in ecological terms. What is the ecological downside, if there is any, there may not be, to imposing the minimum flow on every applicant for renewal, either deemed permits or replacement permits, within one of those given catchments where there are minimum flows?
Okay, in the Manuhirikia, it's not going to make any ecological change from the status quo, because they exceed the minimum flow.
But so that would be provided that they do at least maintain the status quo.
Yeah. The only way that, in common sense to me, is in the Manuhirikia that they won't meet the minimum flow is if they're on full restriction, like Falls Dam is empty and you're in a drought condition, because the only time you don't put water past OFA, if it's not supplying Manuhirikia Irrigation Company in Galloway, that basically means you've run out of water and Falls Dam and you're in a drought. So at that stage, the minimum flow is also irrelevant because you're in drought conditions where everyone is off. Even the deemed permit holders who are not subject to the minimum flow probably have no water to take anyway, or so little it's become irrelevant.
But remembering that, of course, the deemed permits will have expired, so they will be subject to something.
Yep.
This is the question, is should they be subject to the minimum flow?
Ideally, yes.
Okay, thank you. And similarly on the Tyree?
Yes, if we're on the same logic.
The other aspect that I want to talk with you and explore with you, Dr. Alabone, is that currently deemed permits have a priority system, so that for deemed permits, mining privileges that were granted earlier in time, they always take priority over mining privileges, deemed permits that were granted later in time, no matter where they are in the catchment. And so particularly where you have a higher priority take deemed permit, which is lower down the catchment, that means that lower priority takes higher up the catchment are required to allow a certain proportion of water to continue to flow to ensure that the higher priority deemed permit has sufficient water, and you're nodding, so I'm just going to say that you agree with that.
No, I understand the situation. I've dealt with the priorities, so I was nodding about understanding your question. And yes, you're right in that sense, where you've got a downstream holder with first priority, then they could, as I understand things, request other permit holders to turn off to supply their water. However, the alternative applies as well. If the deemed permit holder with first priority is at the top end of the stream, he can take all the water and everyone downstream is not getting any.
Yep.
And if the plan change changes that so that they have to share evenly, then that priority will then disappear and you'd share. And it would depend, again, if there's any water sharing agreements amongst the users on how they deal with that resource. So there's a theoretical one, kind of what you've presented, and the real world might be kind of different.
So just thinking about Plan Change 7, and as described by Mr. Moore in his submissions this morning, the intention for the controlled activity is that this would be a continuation of existing activities without exacerbating effects on the environment. That's what the controlled activity pathway is intended to maintain, the status quo. If you have a change in priorities because they are not rolled over as part of Plan Change 7, does that affect your answer?
Um, I think I stick with it depends very much on there might be a consent framework that the people are working with, but there will also be user agreements on how they may share that. So it's very hard to know. I'm not good with the planning side of this. Sure. How this would pan out, you know, in terms of operationally, what users would do when the priorities are not there, how they operate them now may not reflect always how the priorities are.
So let's put to one side what users are doing. Let's just think about what users' rights currently are. So that's saying that they have priorities and they're exercising them.
Yes.
Yep. And that's the current hydrology of those streams, water bodies, the current ecosystems of those streams, water bodies, is accustomed to those priorities, isn't it?
I'm uncomfortable with the word accustomed, but yes.
it's what they know, if I put it that way.
Okay. Yep.
Yep. If you then introduce a degree of variability by not maintaining those priorities, you don't actually know what that change in flow is going to, what effect that is going to have on the ecosystems and the habitats, do you?
Well, it's a yes and a no. It's a yes and a no, in a sense.
It's a yes and a no, okay.
Because in some ways you're talking about a very sort of narrow window, you could say, of what's going on. This year, for instance, we've had a very wet January, and all the irrigation, as far as I was aware, in Manahirikia was off for a month. So at that stage, the streams are flowing completely natural. Priorities and bits are irrelevant because no one's taking. So the priority issue comes into effect when you have a low flow and the water is not available for all users. So some of the times, the change or lack of priorities will do no change to the flow, and it depends on the rainfall and water use. On a dry year, yes, depending on how the users decide to operate, the change in priorities could change how the flows change down the rivers. So when you say the community is not used to change, I wouldn't accept that, because some years are very different from others. And what we've been modelling at the moment in Goldsmith is exactly that: wet years, dry years, average years, and how it compares to the baseline really varies, but on a wet year there's very little change.
It's a matter of interest. Do you know anything about those, whether or not holders of deed permits are actually exercising those priorities or not? Because we've seen it referenced, but I don't think we've seen it landed anywhere in the evidence in a way which the court could understand as to the scale and significance of those priorities coming up, if in fact they're exercised now.
You'd have to other parties. I get some feeling some are operated, some more enforced than others, but there's also quite a bit of water sharing at times, so I think other parties would be best to answer that, and it might be a case by case. And my experience with deemed permits and issues about that date back 20 years when I've seen real angst over who has water, but I couldn't tell you the situation today.
In catchment?
No, I mean, it's not something I deal with, how the irrigators decide to manage the takes amongst themselves.
The who?
I don't deal with how the irrigators manage
that
allocation issue amongst themselves.
No, really? And so is it accounted for in any model that you've ever seen?
No, things like the Goldstone doesn't, because it treats things as blocks.
Mm.
And it depends very much on how you construct your model. Mm. If you could go to the really detailed level, you could say, yes, take point A here on the stream has priority, so we have to get, just as Ms. Williams has suggested, have to get water to that one, regardless of what's upstream, but downstream we might get none. But you have to have a really complex model to put priority into it. And every take point modelled with its priority assigned, which we can't do for various reasons.
Dr. Rallibone, I understand that in the Manahirikia catchment, one of the consents, current deemed permits, which certainly does have a higher priority, is the Manahirikia Irrigation Company race, which is, as you've described, at least partway down the catchment, if not towards the lower end of the catchment. And I understand it's below the minimum flow?
Yes, it's below the minimum flow site, yes.
So there is a potential for an impact there, isn't there?
Yes, my understanding is, and again, subject to parties confirming this, is that the four main takes on the Mount Ahuriki ration evenly, and we have to check that with the irrigators. So if as water storage in Falls Dam drops, and so they have to go to 75% take, all four of the big users take a 25% cut. So as I understand it, Mount Ahuriki in that scenario are not operating a priority and saying we'll keep 100%, the rest of you guys can take the cut. They're not doing that as I understand things, but that would be best put to Mount Ahuriki Irrigation Company.
So you would agree then that it would be important for the council to continue control over the rules or operation procedures of relevant water allocation committees that exist for the catchment?
I don't deal with that.
All right.
And I don't know how much control council has on water allocation committees.
All right. No, I think I'll leave it there, Your Honour.
Thank you. Ms. Baker Galloway.
Ms. Dixon.
So, as with Mr. Henderson, I'd like you to have the Forest and Birds. Forest and Birds. My client's evidence, Fish and Game.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not looking for any job. In front of you, please, and go to Mr. Farrell's evidence again, thanks.
Ooh. Well, I'm not sure I have his evidence. I've got Mr. Trotter's, Dr. Hayes's, and Mr. Cole's.
Oh, it'll be in the... Is it the same folder?
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Okay.
So if you go to past page 31 of his evidence, and then there's the appendix.
Yes.
And then flick over a couple of pages till you get to policy 10A23.
Yes.
So just to help you understand why I'm asking you these questions, this is the policy that's intended to provide direction about when non-complying consents might be appropriate. So consents that are for longer than 6 years or for more water than currently used, in a nutshell.
Thank you.
And one of the issues that some submitters have is that the policy could be much clearer in its direction about the acceptable threshold of effects. What it said as notified is that under paragraph A is that activity might be appropriate if it has no more than minor adverse effects on the ecology of the water body. So it's this no more than minor phrase that I'm interested in discussing with you. As you've explained in your evidence, habitat modelling in Otago, you need more time, or your recommendation is that more time is needed for the relevant habitat models until they're fit for purpose. Is that a fair summary?
Some places, yes. Some places we're good. some places where, yeah, the models exist, they just need to be updated in terms of the habitat preferences used. Some places there's no models, so you have nothing. And some places, like the original Lindis model, the model is just uninterpretable and you throw it out and start again. So the Lindis, I hope, is a one-off aberration in that sense. But so there's a series of issues. Mm. Some we can step straight to, some we can't.
And you've agreed with Dr. Hayes, you're both reasonably on the same page in that regard in terms of work being required to yep. update the models so that they are provide a more reliable outcome answer.
Yeah, especially for the older models. I mean, when you look at what I did personally back in 2008, 2007 for the council, we were just modelling fish habitat. These days we do invertebrates and algal species, so you look at the whole food web as well as the fish. So there are old models that are still valid models but haven't modelled all of the things we would do today. They're really easy to update. Then there are places with no models and there are places with models that just they don't fit best practice, so you'd want to do them again. Yeah.
So if we had a policy directive that required no more than minor adverse effects for this interim plan change, if that was assessed on a case-by-case basis, there's no guarantee that there's models that are fit for purpose to make that assessment, is there?
No, one of the things is that we tend to do the models for the big rivers. We don't do it for every little stream. It would be just impossible. We wouldn't do it for something that runs, you know, 50 litres a second, you know, as a mean flow, never mind a mouth of, say, 10 or something. So we use modelling for the big rivers and the important places. For the small streams and little flows, you're just going to come up with some much simpler method. And that's what the 2008 Becker report was suggesting as well.
The what, sorry?
The 2008 Becker report that Dr. Hayes refers to, the draft minimum flow guidelines, whatever it's called.
The draft, or let's get it right for the record, the draft National Environmental Standard for yeah. Ecological Flows.
Yeah, thank you. You know, for very small streams and small takes, you don't go to much effort. For big rivers and high value areas, you go to a lot of effort to get it right. Mm. So it's a moving sort of target, this one, in terms of what you do for what places.
Yeah. So just let's jump into Dr. Hayes' evidence then. So this is Dr. Hayes, who's another expert for fish and game. And if you go to, I'd like you to go to paragraph 46 of his evidence. Where, so again, just a bit of backstory. Instead of using a test of no more than minor effects on ecological values, for the purpose of this plan change, what Fish and Game are proposing is a proxy for that no more than minor ecological effect, and instead just using the degree of hydrological alteration with reference to MALF. So, and this is, as you'll see in paragraph 46, Dr. Hayes has taken this in part from the recommendations in that draft National Environmental Standard on Ecological Flows. And, for example, paragraph 47 proposes as a trigger that for rivers that have a mean flow of less than 5 cumecs, the trigger be a minimum flow of less than 90% of 7-day MALF, and an allocation of more than 20% of MALF would trigger that no more than minor threshold. Would you agree with that as a trigger for a no more than minor threshold?
So below that threshold, you think we would undertake work to assess things?
Well, it's just, the context it's proposing is to set a quantifiable objective threshold in the policy rather than no more than minor.
Certainly, I think 90% of MALF is and above would be, conservative is the right word, but pretty safe in terms of if you're fluctuating, reducing the flow, that amount, yes, you're not going to have a significant change. Once you go below that, you may not have a significant change, but, yeah, you could use that as a cutoff and be reasonably comfortable that things would be, yeah, good.
So, I mean, Dr. Hayes' words in 47 are that that those restrictions would, if you breach those, would potentially have more than minor effects on life supporting capacity, ecosystem health, mahika kai and fisheries amenity values?
Yeah, I think it stretches a little bit, in that the potential is the key word there. And at 89%, how much different is it from 90%? We couldn't measure. If you go to 50%, you would notice it for some species. And if I took the Manahera Kea as an example, where we've modelled the trout habitat in the lower river, the mouth is estimated to be around 3.9, and you can drop the river to around 2 cumics, so it's nearly 50%, and that habitat proportion for them hasn't changed. It's changed the food available to them, possibly, by both the drift rate and the amount of habitat for them, but the habitat for the trout hasn't changed. So it depends very much on how the individual habitat preferences respond, or habitat use changes with the flow and the type of shape of the river. But 90% is fairly safe. Where it becomes problematic below that varies with species and river type. So I'd be happy with 90% as a cut-off.
So just to be clear, the 90% is for rivers with a mean flow less than 5 cumics?
Yes.
And then the next paragraph down, for rivers with a mean flow greater than 5 cumics, the recommendation is minimum flow trigger of 80% of MELF and allocation of 30% of MELF as the trigger, the threshold.
I'm a little less comfortable, not because it might not be correct, but because I'm just not experienced working with the bigger rivers. You know, we do spend a lot of time in wadeable streams rather than things the size of the Clutha and that. So I'd reserve judgment on that one if I could, please.
No, that's fine. And my last set of questions is just in relation to just picking up a comment of yours in your summary at paragraph 10. And this is in relation to how to manage species interaction between salmonids and galaxids. And your paragraph 10 in your summary agrees and confirms that PC7 will not establish residual flow and remove the drying reaches that are currently excluding salmonids from some galaxid populations. You do agree, though, that there's other work in play between the relevant statutory agencies to address species interaction that's ongoing?
I'm not privy to the conversations between the department and Fish and Game.
Okay, well that's fine. That clears that up. You do agree that leaving a river to run dry is not the only way you can continue to exclude salmonids from galaxid populations. You can have imposition of artificially constructed fish barriers, can't you?
Yeah, they're not as easy to put in as you'd like sometimes. I mean, you need some fall. A good barrier ideally either needs a... natural ones we find have to be at 3 metres high. Now, if you've got a stream of low gradient, getting a 3 metre high barrier into it, if it doesn't have the bank slope either, you end up creating a very large reservoir, which is not what you want. So it's technically challenging, and, there are some spots where it's... areas you might like to put a barrier in, a physical barrier, but it's not feasible because of the river morphology. And say a highly mobile braided riverbed, you're not going to try it at all. So it's horses for courses.
If the leaving the river in a case where it continues to run dry from time to time, that could also have an adverse effect on the non-migratory galaxids in terms of food production, invertebrate food production. compared to restoring flows?
Well, that's an interesting one. There's only one study done on galaxid sort of food consumption. Dr. Alex Huron, one of the guys who sort of supervised some of my PhD work years ago, did work in Sutton and Stony Stream on the Rock and Pillars. And his conclusion from the galaxid work after 3 years was they consume about 30% of the invertebrate production in the stream. The other 70% just accumulates and hatches as insects and flies off to be eaten by spiders or whatever. So they utilise, in his experiment, the same one that's been done, or study, relatively small amount of the invertebrate production. So if you halved it, you may not impact on them at all because they're not tied strongly to that invertebrate production in terms of maintaining their population abundance and health. Conversely, trout, with the other hand, they used 100% plus of the production. So yeah, you would impact on trout as you reduce the invertebrate diversity because their diet would be limited. Galaxids, maybe not. And it depends on the scale of that reduction.
But if you were managing a river for its overall health, if there's been a vision set in terms of te mana or te wai, it's preferable to restore meaningful flows, isn't it, rather than leave them dewatered?
Yeah, unless they're natural drying reaches, yes.
Thank you, ma'am. No further questions.
Mr. Anderson.
I don't have anything to add to what my friend has said.
Thank you. Mr. Irving. Bridget Irving. Ms. Irving. Sorry.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Alban. I'd just like to start with a point made in your summary document, in particular paragraph 6, where you discuss the habitat loss in relation to mudfish, and just wanting to clarify what we're talking about there. Does that relate to the image at page 17 of your evidence in chief? Yes, page 17. I think it's figure number 4.
Okay. Partly, it just means the wetlands on that south bank of the Waitaki are vulnerable to willow encroachment and issues like that. They're not vulnerable to water abstraction. Although I did find out late last week that there's a management plan in place being operated by Environment Canterbury for the area. And, looking to manage habitat issues for the populations there, so I suspect they're reasonably well looked after.
And do you know if any of the permits in that area are deemed permits or permits subject to Plan Change 7?
No.
I'd like to talk about, I suppose, one of the key themes in your evidence around gaps in knowledge in relation to fish. I think at paragraph 81 of your evidence in chief, you talk about establishing research programs taking sort of 2 to 3 years in your experience. Is that correct?
Yes.
And is it true that those research programs can be affected by weather conditions from season to season?
When I'm talking about spawning and spawning timing of its species, no. If you were talking habitat modelling stuff in low flow years, yes, that gets problematic.
And is that one of the challenges you've faced in, say, the Cadrona catchment or the Upper Manuhirikia recently?
Certainly the flow modelling issues have been difficult to deal with because we've had flood events, yeah.
And so that type of issue would tend to extend the period of time required to gather the information you need?
It can do, or you just decide if it's important that after a flood event you go back and you have another go rather than waiting for another year. If you had a flood in January, you go back in February and start again rather than abandon it until December the next year. So it's a bit of a choices and how much money you or what you think the weather's going to do. But,
and presuming the flows behave themselves and you can get the type of characteristics you need to do your assessment.
I think for the most part, if you have to do it, you will get it done.
Right. Can you recall when the Regional Council have said they will be notifying the Land and Water Plan?
I believe it's 2023.
December 2023. So okay. Would you expect all of the research programs take 2 to 3 years to be completed for notification of that plan?
Yes, I expect that's what we're going to have to do.
You also talk about a range of data sources that you've utilised for assessing ecological values. Fisheries database, the Otago Regional Council State of the Environment monitoring, to the extent that it covers the areas you need.
I think I mentioned that the SOE doesn't cover the areas, and the database covers a lot, but it has issues with historic versus current data.
So the State of the Environment monitoring is of zero assistance to you?
Not zero, but when you have 8 sites for the whole of the province, it's only going to assist in local areas.
So it's part of the equation.
Yeah, but it's not a big part.
And there's survey work undertaken by applicants for resource consents?
That's all part of what you can pull into the picture.
And your own eDNA data that you're producing?
That is it's a science project, you say, at the moment that is being developed, and it will, what we're doing at the moment is developing the genetic markers so that when you take a water sample you have appropriate markers to detect what's upstream. So it's ongoing, and I do it as a voluntary contribution to it as I cruise around. MFE, I believe, and other parties are working on sort of a more funded approach.
So there's, I suppose, a range of data that we have at the moment that we will pull together, and you say that there's more research that you will do in the coming years that will feed into the consent process and the plan change process.
I would hope so, yes.
And in essence, those sources of data will be the same?
So by the same, you mean?
The same data will be used to inform the Land and Water Plan as well as renewals of consents.
I would assume so, yes. It wouldn't.
What do you mean the same data? Sorry, I'm a bit confused.
Well, the same sources of data, Your Honour, the fisheries databases, fish survey work that's done by the council or applicants on consent.
So it's the proposition that there's going to be no additional research?
Correct.
Is that correct? There is going to be no additional research from here till, I don't know, 2025?
I believe the council has a plan to undertake more work.
You understand that they have a plan?
Yeah, and Dr. Everett Hinks will address that.
Okay, all right.
But my point is that information will be used both in relation to the plan and in relation to resource consents.
I expect so.
I'd like to talk about flow management. And at paragraph 97 of your evidence in chief, you got that paragraph?
Yep.
So in that you talk about the range of tools that the council uses to manage water use. Can you tell me what of those tools are being utilised in Plan Change 7?
Off the top of my head, I think the instantaneous rates of takes, the monthly and yearly allocations.
And no minimum flows.
That would depend on the consent conditions if for new...
For replacement of deemed permits.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I can answer that, honestly. I've read the plan change, but I want to go back to it further and get it correct.
Okay. In your experience in resource consent renewals that you've been involved with, is it routine for those to be granted subject to minimum flows where they exist?
Yes.
Is it routine for consents to be granted subject to residual flows where they are necessary?
Yes.
Is it routine for consents to be granted with instantaneous take limits?
Yes.
Annual volumes?
Yes.
Monthly volumes?
Yeah, I don't do anything with the set of them, but I recall them going on to consents at times, yes.
So for the most part, all of the tools that you list in your paragraph?
Are used when they can be, yeah.
And I'd like to talk briefly about galaxids. I'm going to call them non-migratory galaxids. I understand in answer to questions from my colleague Ms Williams that you consider the Clutha flathead and the Central Otago roundhead to be the key species that are likely to be affected by consents renewed under Plan Change 7?
Yes.
And in light of your understanding about their existing distribution, the habitat that they occupy, would you consider the habitat to be critical habitat?
Given they're nationally threatened species, yeah, all their habitat would be critical.
And in your view, we should protect that critical habitat?
Yes.
And I understand from your evidence that you view salmonids to be the most significant threat to... those non-migratory species?
To all of them, yes.
Would you agree that habitat such as Thompson's Creek and the Manuhirikia is the type of habitat that we need to be protecting?
Yeah, in light of a quick discussion with Mr Hickey earlier today, in particular in some survey work we did in February, it has some very good populations of Central Otago roundheads, according to what's been told to me.
Are you familiar with Leahy's Creek?
Yes.
Which creek,
though? Leahy's Creek.
It's spelled L-A-H-E-Y-S. It's a tributary of Chatto Creek in the Manuhirikia.
I think it's discussed in Mr Allibone's rebuttal evidence. And Leahy's Creek, as I recall, has roundhead galaxids in it?
Central Otago roundheads, yes.
And their habitat is being protected, I suppose, at the moment by the absence of a residual flow to continue to exclude salmonids?
Yeah, probably for the benefit of the court, Leahy's Creek is one I've worked with the applicant on for a number of years. They have a take near the base of the Dunstan Range, which takes... during low flow periods, 100% of the flow, or almost, there's a bit of leakage. So downstream of the take, 500 metres downstream from the take, the stream is dry, and it probably remains dry for, I think, about 6 kilometres. At the 6 kilometre mark, we have some springs. Some of them are possibly fed by leakage from the irrigation schemes, some just natural resurfacing of groundwater. And at the springs and downstream for... I've got to get a downstream limit, but I suspect about 500 metres, maybe a little bit further, there's a population of Central Otago roundheads. And then we get into a slightly larger stream as it has a confluence with another tributary, and we start to pick up brown trout in reasonable numbers and the galaxids disappear. So there's a small population in a short section of spring-fed stream, and along that 500 metres there's a spring at the top, and then there's a lot of groundwater inflows, and I believe Lampro gauged it at one stage, and at the confluence point it's about 30 litres a second, so it rises from zero to 500 metres about 30 litres in summer. And yeah, sitting in there is a little population of roundheads that, yeah, there are trout upstream and downstream of them. They're upstream in the Leahy's Creek above the water take. The drying reach obviously has nothing. And then we have trout downstream of them again in Chateau Creek itself. So they're sandwiched. So we call them sandwich populations, stuck between trout on upstream and downstream. That gives you an insight into what I hope.
And from your recollection, so the drying reach is believed to be induced by irrigation?
Believed to be. I question that a little bit in my own head because we've never done any gauging down the stream during normal flow periods, and we see a lot of the tributaries coming off the Dunstan Range. They run across alluvial fans, so there'll be some losses to groundwater, and that's where the spring is groundwater sourced, whether it's all irrigation leakage from the race or whether it's some natural. Whether that groundwater losses to groundwater across the alluvial fan is sufficient to dry it, whether it occurs, hasn't been investigated. So there's some doubt on just how natural or unnatural the losses are across there.
Just I digress slightly, but there's a galaxid management plan imposed as a condition of the resource consent for that creek, isn't there?
Yes.
So I'd like to, staying with Leahy's for a moment, I think Ms Baker-Galloway referred you to the evidence of Dr Hayes and the idea of setting a threshold for minimum flows and allocation limits in waterways. Based on, and I think Ms Baker-Galloway said the minimum flows are between 80 to 90% of naturalised mouth,
yep,
depending on the size of the waterway, and an allocation block of 20 to 30% of mouth, naturalised mouth. That's your understanding?
Yep.
Setting those default limits, would they have the risk of enabling salmonids' passage into currently isolated galaxid habitats, in your view?
Yeah, it's one of the issues, and it's the most problematic balancing issue we have here. To restore flows in some areas, to what being suggested there, you end up putting the galaxids at more risk. And it's why, again, I classify the salmonids as more of a problem than the trout. You can play with the irrigation abstraction and reduce its impacts quite easily, but in doing so, you can let trout go into places that you don't want them to be in, and it adds this level of complexity to all of the water management decisions. And again, why Central Otago Roundhead is the most threatened. It sits on the valley floor in amongst the abstraction points and the trout, and if you play with one, like the PCCT, if you play with the irrigation abstraction without managing the predatory fish issue, you get outcomes you might not want in terms of protecting the fish. So that's, again, if you got rid of the trout, you could deal with the irrigation any way you liked because there wouldn't be a constraint. But at the moment, the interactions between irrigation and salmonids constrain how you can manage the water takes, and sometimes you definitely don't want to put a residual flow in or a connecting flow for some of these populations.
In your view, would enabling trout into the habitat of galaxids be an adverse effect that was more than minor?
Yeah. Yes.
And would it be in direct contravention to policies in the NPS around protecting the habitat of Indigenous fish?
Yeah, I could be pedantic and say no, because you're protecting the habitat, you're just not protecting the fish. And that's one thing with the NPS, when it says habitat all the time, you can protect the habitat, but you can ruin the fish population. Letting trout in will be detrimental to the fish. It won't necessarily be detrimental to the habitat.
Be a bit self-defeating to kill, yes, all of the fish but leave them with some habitat.
Yep, exactly. But it's what the NPS says, unfortunately.
I'm sure Ms Williams will have something to say about that.
Well, it does also say we have to be taking into account threatened species, so I think that would give us some cover there.
Lastly, I'd like to talk to you about habitat modelling. I just want to clarify before I ask you a few questions. You refer to habitat models in paragraph 32 of your evidence in chief, and I think it's where you say there's 15 or so that you have produced.
Yes, that's correct. I recall doing a few, yes. Sure, I said it.
It might be in your reply evidence, yeah. Actually. Sorry, Mr. Elliger. Yes, in your rebuttal evidence, paragraph 32. And then you discuss them again in paragraph 50.
Sorry, which was the first one?
Paragraph 32.
Thank you. Yes.
So are those habitat models essentially the same, the ones you talk about constructing in paragraph 32, and then the ones that you discuss in paragraph 50 as requiring some updating?
Yes and no. I've done 15 as a Golder Associates contractor to the council in, I think, 2007, 2008. NIWA did a whole lot previously in sort of 2003 to 2005, and all of them need updating because none of them did invertebrates and algal taxa. And the older NIWA ones, we're also not sure if we can get the raw data to rerun the models. It seems a third party might have it, but NIWA don't always have it. So, yeah, there's a mix of ones I've done and ones that NIWA have done.
Right, so where they require updating, additional curves, updating of the curves, how long does that take?
I can do, if the habitat preference curves are there, we can do it in 5 minutes, the model run.
You also discuss in your evidence the challenges with the habitat model in the Lindis case. Can you explain to me what the issue was there?
The issues were multiple. For a start, the model was built in two places on the river. One, a reach up near the upstream flow monitoring site. I can't recall the name. Anyway, on a stable flow section of the river. The other 8 cross-sections were built down on the losing reach by the Lindis crossing. So they were split by several kilometres of river and some losing and gaining reaches. So when you look at the flow up the 7 cross-sections at the top, it would be quite different to what it is down the bottom. And yet all of the cross-sections put together in a single model that said, say, for trout habitat, 700 litres a second is what we want. But it didn't say where 700 litres a second is in the river. Because was it in the drying reach down the bottom or the stable flow reach up the top? And how the other thing with it, when they went and did the calibration, you do a set of cross-sections, you go back twice to calibrate the model on different flows. When they went to the drying reach to do the last calibration, it was dry. And I have no idea how they modelled zero flow, because you don't know essentially how that flow compared to upstream. When it went dry, it might have been 400 litres upstream or 200 litres upstream. So how are they married? There were 7 cross sections about Lindis Crossing, I think it is, which is well upstream. Not Lindis Crossing, can't be. Near the, I'm just trying to remember the name of it. The upper flow recorder, anyway. There's 2 flow recorders.
Lindis
on
Peaks.
Lindis Peaks, yeah, thank you. And then there were 8 down at Lindis Crossing, which is where the state highway crosses the lower Lindis, and that is a drying reach. So it loses flow as you go through the reach. So that, for a start, violates one of the assumptions of the Rye-Hibson model. You're supposed to have the same flow at all cross-sections. Putting it across a drying reach meant that every reach downstream had a slightly lower flow than the previous one, so that's a small violation you can account for. But how you married up those 8 lower cross sections with the 7 upstream ones, which are in a very different flow environment, to come up with a single flow recommendation for a particular species was, I think it would be called mind-boggling to all of the experts. As a commissioner, I asked every expert how to interpret that model, and they all said, we have no idea. And the other issue with it was that while we had a flow, sort of flow habitat relationship that none of us understood, that wasn't related to the minimum flow point. So because of that, when you say, oh, the model says 700 litres a second is good, for instance, you don't know whether that's 500 litres or 200 litres or a cumic at the minimum flow point to get that. There's no relation between that. And the decision was about making a minimum flow, amongst other things. So you have a model that's totally unrelated to the minimum flow site. It's just unworkable. You cannot use it for a decision. And the fact that none of the experts at the hearing built the model or could explain it, I mean, we had no one who could even interpret it. It was a very, very bizarre model that we've never seen anywhere else done like that and hopefully won't again.
So, as a matter of interest, is this a hearing that you sat on as an independent commissioner, or was this
a
hearing in front of Commissioner Edmonds?
I was an independent commissioner for the Lindis plan change, the original.
And do we know whether or not that changed when it got to court or not?
Yeah, I believe they did a completely new model.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the purpose of the question? You're going somewhere, and you're going to lose us unless you start to now signal what your case is, to put it bluntly. Where are you going with this?
Yes, well, what I'd like to talk to Mr. Allibone about is the need for the habitat modelling to be related to the flow conditions in the water body. And in particular, we need to understand not just the minimum flow, but also where water is being abstracted from the water body, so that we can understand the relationship between the habitat.
Your theory of your case will be what? That.
Broadly?
Broadly, yes, broadly. Well, what is the theory of the case? That, in fact, you can't have 6 years of consent recorded?
Our theory of the case is, in essence, that Plan Change 7 is going to defer achieving environmental gains that can be achieved now.
Well, I know that broadly, that's hyper-broadly. I'm actually, what's your theory of your case? Because you're running a case now in terms of minimum flows and take, I think.
Yes, and I think, as we talked about, as Mr. Allibone agreed, Plan Change 7 doesn't seek to impose minimum flows, and it won't impose residual flows unless those conditions were already part of the deemed permit or resource consent that are being renewed.
It will carry over minimum flows, though, won't it? If already on a consent, it'll carry over, but it won't introduce any new minimum flows.
Correct.
Some parties want it, and that's a different issue.
Yes. And in deemed permits, predominantly there are no minimum flows, and that's the majority of the consents that this plan change will apply to.
That's interesting. It's actually a matter for evidence, which some of the background information that we're struggling with, I don't think we've got an impression at all from this evidence as to what consents are out there with minimum flows. So good that you flag it, because we're wondering what is the state of the environment. But anyway, where are you going, though? I really want to understand what your theory is, because I don't follow the line of questioning or its relevance. If I don't follow it now, I won't follow it later.
Yeah. So Mr. Allibone talks about habitat modelling and whether or not it is a useful tool for assessing effects. And we say that it is, but that it also requires a degree of detail about the flow regime that you are assessing. And that requires not only minimum flows and residual flows, but an understanding of the abstraction regime that will be affecting the water body and therefore the habitat availability within it.
Just wait a second. So habitat modelling is relevant and important?
Yes.
But it has to be related back to an abstraction regime, by which you mean under resource consent, presumably.
Yes.
And whole of catchment or sub-catchment minimum flow, correct?
Yes.
And residuals.
And I think one of the challenges that Mr. Allibone encountered perhaps with the habitat modelling during the plan change hearing was the lack of a detailed abstraction regime that allowed the habitat model to be related to flow conditions at various points along the river.
And so is your proposition will be that if there is no flow regime linked to an abstraction regime, so minimum flows attached to resource consents, therefore no meaningful link can be made to habitat? Is that where your proposition? Is that where we're going? So therefore chuck out plan change 7 before it allow abstractors to pursue on a resource consent minimum flow regime?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so. Okay. All right, so that's the proposition.
Yes.
Really, that's underlying your whole case, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Right.
Your Honour, may I just add a bit to a question I answered before? Just with respect to Leahy's Creek, just quickly. One of the, Miss Williams and Miss Baker Galloway sort of talked a little bit about changing flows and particularly the change of the priorities, but also, and I mentioned, you know, high flow years, you don't get the drying reaches. One of the things I haven't done for Leahy's Creek, because it's where I do some work, is have a look at it in a drying, in a wet year. We've looked at it in a dry year when we did the work. In a wet year, I don't know the state of that drying reach, whether it's still occurring or whether it's actually flowing through a summer and a wet year. So we have a sort of biased assessment in a slight sense there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So we'll come back to habitat models. And the discussion I was having with you about the utility of understanding the flow regime when you are completing your habitat modelling.
Well, I think for a basic habitat model, you just need to make the model. Then you, as long as you can relate it to a minimum flow site or an abstraction in terms of you have a flow relationship between the two, and or the model applies to that reach, that's a key part, then you can just read off the model what you get, you know, in terms of habitat for different flows.
So you need to understand either the level of abstraction that's affecting the reach you're assessing or the minimum flow that applies to that catchment.
Well, both, ideally.
Thank you. I have no further questions, Your Honour.
Thank you. I'm going to ask re-examination. I've got one follow-up question in relation to something that Dr. Allibone has said, but have you got any re-examination? You do? Okay,
do.
Good. Okay, you go for it. So as not to confound things by anything, any subsequent question of mine, I'll leave it till after your re-examination.
Very good.
Yep.
Now, just picking up on that last series of questions, and the articulation of the case theory, which may or may not have morphed into a question, but I just want to understand your opinion on whether it is required in order to understand effects on ecology for there to be a series, or for there to be a consent application produced. And I'd put my question to you this way. Can you use the model that's generated and run a series of scenarios through that model to understand the effects on, for example, habitat quantity through the model that's constructed?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a model of how habitat changes with flow. You can look at it under, as the river changes flow just naturally through the year, this is the habitat it provides. It doesn't need an abstraction or anything. The model is a model. It's the questions you ask it is the important bit, I guess, of what you want out of it.
So you don't need a resource consent application in order to understand different flow scenarios.
No.
The other matter on which I wished to ask you about relates to paragraph 97 of your evidence in chief, and there you had a list of the tools that were available in terms of impositions being put on consents under the current regime. Now, in your experience, when conditions are being framed up with respect to those matters, are they taking into account values that have been set through the NPSFM 2020 process?
Not to date, because we haven't had the NPS 2020.
Thank you. No further questions.
Just two clarifying questions from me. I asked you a question about water quality and surrounding land use, and I thought you said, and I may have picked it up wrong, that water quality does not impact on habitat. But at your paragraph 43 of your evidence in chief, you seem to say the contrary, and I was just really wondering where you were landing with that.
Yeah, it refers to the fish, and you will, with water quality, get issues like with nitrate toxicity if it is high enough. So the habitat becomes unoccupiable when the water quality conditions are detrimental.
But you could also get other impacts, couldn't you, in terms of a change in the macroinvertebrates available for fish for feeding, if water
yes.
quality is impacting them, then there's not food for the fish, there's not food for the fish, then the fecundity of the fish drops away and all those.
Yep.
In fact, isn't there a host of associated, there's a range of changes in water quality which may together or by themselves or together impact habitat conditions, which...
Yeah, it's probably not the habitat conditions, but the, and I got that probably slightly wrong there, but just the water quality will impact on the flora and fauna of the stream, and as the water quality changes, you will get a response from that aquatic community, which may be a reduction or in some cases an increase, depending on how they deal with the water quality change. Like extra nutrients, you'll probably get more algal biomass and macrophytes, whereas... In fact, the other opposite happens with Didymo. When you get very low phosphorus, it tends to bloom. So the water quality issue will drive changes to the communities as they respond. And it may be a toxicity or it may be just a growth rate change or abundance.
Yeah, so how are you using the word habitat? What do you mean by habitat?
Well, that's probably in that section 43 with the water quality. It probably should just say... A reduction in abundance when you're referring to the fish is possible through the water quality changes. But what we don't know is how the galaxids in particular respond. There's not a lot of environmental tolerance information for them. So, and as I said before, they're not necessarily food limited. So you can see some changes in the invertebrates that may have no impact on them if they're not food limited. And so... It's hard to quantify what the response would be to changes in water quality. Dr. Dunn and I tried a bit of work in the Upper Manahirikea looking at temperature tolerances because we thought there was a limitation on the alpine galaxid up there. Mm. When it turned out that the threshold we thought was above their tolerance at about 14 degrees was exceeded in much of the river through the summer and they were still there. So that's where our understanding is, well, even one aspect of their sort of water quality tolerances is not wonderful on one fish. So it's flagged as an issue, and as you say, it stems up through the whole community. We probably have better ideas that invertebrates, especially like mayflies and caddisflies, respond to water quality decline as the water quality goes down, their abundance does, which has impacts on the food web.
Habitat, are you defining habitat quite narrowly in terms of the space that these things occupy? You are, as opposed to the conditions of that space.
Yeah.
That's actually important to know, isn't it?
Yeah, so just reading it again, I'd say I wouldn't put loss of habitat due to water quality. I'd just put impacts.
If you are defining habitat as the physical space.
Yes.
If you are defining habitat as the condition of that space, which is required for abundance, if I put it that way, quite a different set of considerations come into play.
If you consider the water they live in as part of the habitat, then it is an impact on the habitat, the changing in water quality. If you consider the habitat, the physical habitat, in terms of the volume of water and the flow and the substrate of the stream, those sort of things, the shape of the stream, then that's physical habitat. And you could say that habitat in general includes water and the quality of that water.
Yeah. But even if you're talking about the physical habitat, so here change in flow,
yes.
For example, resulting in increase in water temperature, resulting in a change of conditions which may or may not be suited for that particular species, I would call that a habitat change, but I don't think you are. I think you're just talking... You've got quite a narrow concept in your evidence, not talking about personally, but in the evidence, the concept of habitat is actually quite a constrained one in terms of physical habitat.
For the most part, yes, that would be correct, yes.
Right, okay. So one other thing that I want to just double check with you. This is it just comes from your summary of evidence, which you tabled this morning, paragraph 22. Now, this probably is in your evidence, but it's quite a neat little paragraph where you're summing up allocation limits and minimum flows being used together. And why they're used together. Yeah.
Yes.
If you have a minimum flow but without an allocation limit, and so here's that'll be signalling questions and clarification for the planners. But if you've got a minimum flow but without an allocation limit, is what you're risking, particularly during the drier periods during the year, that abstractors will bring the river down to a flat line quicker and hold it longer? Is that the potential that you have where minimum flows are imposed without an allocation limit also?
I try to think of a place how you wouldn't have an allocation limit, because normally there's some sort of catchment allocation limit.
Well, PC7, some of the relief seems to suggest that to me.
Okay.
Put everyone on a minimum flow.
Yeah,
but what about the allocation limit?
Okay.
So I'm not quite sure where the planners are going with this.
If we just take it that there's no allocation limit and people have just been allocated or given an instantaneous rate of take, then they can turn on their abstractions and draw the river down, all of them operating together till they get to the minimum flow. Whether that happens quicker than if there's an allocation limit, I doubt it, because responding to the instantaneous rate of take, it's not the allocation limit unless...
Allocation limits you're using, you would say, therefore, am I right in thinking you call allocation limits the daily, monthly or annual volume?
That's allowed to be taken,
that's
yes.
The allocation limit. Okay. So if you have the minimum flow together with those volumes, then you shouldn't be bringing the river rapidly down to a level where it has flatlined at the minimum flow.
Yeah, I can't comment on the rate it would come down. My perception was Dr. Hayes has a nice diagram of the minimum flow and an allocation limit showing some small freshes exceeding the allocation limit, so you get some extra water in the stream. And that's, again, what I was supporting, his sort of figure there, that an allocation limit can be used to allow some of those fresh events to pass through the system. If you have a big allocation, you capture a lot of those freshes, if the infrastructure allows you to. But if, you know, whereas if you have a small allocation limit, you get more freshes through, which is beneficial for the stream because it gets some extra water and a bit of flushing and, you know, it's just cooler maybe. Whereas big allocation limit, you take a lot more of those small freshes, so it's...
And again, you may not know, but we have minimum flows, imposed. Are they correlated with proposed volumes on resource consent. So methods, in no. addition to the method that we see in PC7 or not, don't know.
I don't know. I suspect not.
Right, but suspect not. Okay. All right, then those are my questions. Nope. All right, anything arising? Nothing? All right, very good. Thank you, Dr. Halliburne, for your evidence. Thank you very much. So that's us for the day. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll take the evening adjournment and release this witness. And so, yeah, anybody wanting to put up a document on screen, preferably if you have a stick, that is to put the documents on a stick, or prior to commencing cross-examination, at least 10 minutes to email those to Ms. Harlow, and she'll ensure that the documents are ready and can be put up on the stick. If the cross-examination's on the common bundle, well, it'll be there, so we've sorted that out. Is that right? Very good.
Yes, Your Honour.
All right. Very good. Okay, well, thank you. We're adjourned through to 9:30 tomorrow. Thank you.
All rise.